Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. It's hour number two of the show. The program is produced by Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. With us this morning in the studio is Dr. Suzanne Trupin. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has a private practice here in our area. She also teaches at the med school here in Urbana-Champaign. And once a month, on a Monday, she is here to talk about women's health. Usually she comes in prepared to talk about a few things. Sometimes there are stories in the news that have to do with women's health. We want to talk about that, or she has some other topic she'd like to tell you about. So we can take questions on that, but we want you to know that anything else that has to do with her area of practice, you can certainly call, and she'll be happy to talk with you. Whenever we have physicians on the program, I like to try to remind people that there are limits as to what we can do. We can't do diagnosis over the telephone because the doctor can't see you. But we hope that by doing these programs, we'll give you a place to start, a place you can ask some basic questions. It's a way of adding, we hope, to your health knowledge. And then if you have concerns, you need to take that to someone who can see you. But this is a place you can start, and certainly questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you have questions, you can give us a call. Well, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good morning.
There have been a few things in the news recently having to do with women's health. I don't know if there's anything in particular you have in mind wanting to talk about.
I thought the two biggest studies were one in the past month, approximately, I think, were the studies talking about the risk of blood clots in oral Ortho-Evra contraceptive patch users versus taking a oral or a pill form of contraception. And the other big study was whether calcium and vitamin D supplementation should be universal for menopausal women and whether or not it gives any benefit at actually preventing fractures. And I think both those stories generated a lot of interesting and controversy and had a lot of that I could talk about with them.
Yeah. Well, why don't we talk about calcium? Now, for a long, long time, the recommendation has been that that women of all ages, starting when girls are young, and going up through the time, even after menopause, the recommendations is that women should at least get the recommended amount of calcium, and that the idea is you want to make sure that they have strong bones from when they're little girls to where they're women to where they're in menopause, particularly when they're in menopause, because after that, then you start to see the incidence of fractures and bone problems and bone loss. So you want to make sure they have the healthiest bones possible. So we're saying to women, get your calcium. Now, perhaps there's some question about calcium, or maybe about calcium supplementation.
I think basically if you ask any physician who's in primary care or women's health, they would say, well, this new study is provocative and has some question whether calcium supplementation alone after menopause is enough to prevent fractures. I still think that the basic recommendations for calcium have not actually changed. And what you're saying is absolutely correct and part of the problem. We're talking about calcium and bone health over not just a year or two or a short illness. We're talking about your entire life. And what pertains to women in their 50s and 60s now may not pertain to women in their 50s and 60s years and years from now. Women who are in their 50s and 60s probably either never had a pop when they were growing up or it got parceled off in very small increments. So the current group of teens and young women in their 20s may not even have the same nutritional base that we had as we got older. And so recommendations will change over time. Basically, calcium is one of the most important substances in our body. It's necessary for our muscles to contract, meaning even our heart to beat. And we think that it's a very necessary component of our brain function as well. So it's very important for us to be able to have calcium available in our body at all times. And we have this large reservoir of this calcium that is in our skeleton. So our skeleton isn't only for structural support. It is the calcium that we need so that we are designed such that we can mobilize that calcium out of our bone should we need it at any time. And we are designed to eventually take calcium out of the bloodstream and replenish the bone. But we need hormonal signals to be able to do that. And we know that as we enter puberty and our estrogen levels start to rise, we start to deposit more calcium into our bones and we reach our maximum bone density in our skeleton, somewhere in our early 20s. And starting about in our 30s, we start to lose about 0.5% of our skeleton per year. And then as older individuals, we lose somewhere between 0.5% and 1% per year. In menopausal times, we lose between 2 and 4% of bone per year. So we have this phenomenon that already occurs with bone loss. And it's been well studied that the thinner your bones are, the more likely they are to fracture from whatever happens. The effects of gravity can produce fractures in our spine as we get old enough and the bones get thin enough. So that our goal is to not only have thick bones, but our goal is to have bones that do not fracture. And again, the whole calcium story is a long, long story. And we know that to study fracture prevention takes large groups of patients over long periods of time. And it's actually a fairly difficult thing to study because you need so many patients to show statistically benefit in one direction or another. And this has always been a problem with some of the research studies. So early on, we did studies, we meaning the scientific community, did studies showing that there was a statistical correlation between a thick bone and one that doesn't fracture. And the thinner that you get in the early stages, and we've now defined those stages as osteopenia, so low bone mass but not really a disease, you get thinner. And in the early stages, you really don't see, you see bone loss, but you don't see increased rate of fracture because the bones are still pretty thick. As you get to a certain cutoff, and we've defined that cutoff as osteoporosis, you see an increased rate of fracture. So you get too thin, you will have an increased rate of fracture. So we have two ways of studying osteoporosis. One is to look at whether groups fracture, and the other is to look at whether groups maintain or lose their bone density. So that when we do research studies that look specifically at bone density, we call that a secondary endpoint. Starts getting very, very complicated. And when we think that is an important secondary endpoint because we know ultimately you're less likely to fracture the thicker your bones are. And when we do studies of fractures, we know that there are other factors, not just the thickness of the bone, but we think the thickness of the bone is probably responsible for about 75% of the strength of bone, so that we are focusing on this thickness, but we know there's something else. So whenever you see a study like the recent one that said that calcium and vitamin D didn't help to prevent fractures, you have to think about what else was going on. They did see some benefit on the secondary endpoint of the thickness of the bone, so that you would think maybe ultimately patients would still have benefited. And also you have to think about the type of the route of calcium and how tightly controlled the administration of that calcium was and the dose of calcium. So in this particular study, they used the dose of 1,000 milligrams of calcium and 400 of vitamin D. And these dosages were actually below what we generally recommend and what the National Osteoporosis recommends, but only a little bit below. And what they showed in this study is that there was no difference in the group that was given calcium and vitamin D versus the group that wasn't given calcium and vitamin D in terms of fracture prevention, except for maybe the oldest group of patients. They might have had a few statistically fewer fractures. There was another problem with the study. They looked at clinically apparent fractures so that if somebody reported a fracture, they sought out her bone density tests, her x-rays, her MRIs, and they had experts look at those studies to confirm of what they thought the report was. But there are fractures of the bones that in the early stages are subclinical, and they really didn't go after those. So that was a problem with the study. Also, by the end of the study, only 59% of patients was faithfully even taking that dose of the calcium and vitamin D. So one would have to ask, maybe if the dose was a little bit low to begin with, and maybe because 40% of the population didn't even really get it, could you really be so firm about these conclusions that calcium and vitamin D are not of benefit to the average patient as she gets older?
And there's also this thing that in addition to you need to have the vitamin D with calcium, you also need to have some weight-bearing exercise for it to make its way into your bones. So if you're not,
right.
If you weren't doing that, then you might also ask the question, well, you're not doing everything that you really need to be doing to get that incorporated into the bone.
Which is why hopefully the physicians will pay attention to this study, think about its implications for individual patients. But for individual patients, I think we need to delve a little bit deeper into your health. And if you are relatively big bone and you have very low risk factors for a fracture and your current bone density is normal and your current diet is fairly good in calcium and supplemental vitamin D, because, you know, many of our milk products are fortified with vitamin D. Yes, that may be a patient that does not need to have extra calcium and vitamin D. But the flip side is there are many patients out there that haven't had their calcium measured. They haven't had their vitamin D measured. They have other risk factors for fractures. And when we're talking about protecting your bones, we're not talking about a 5-year study. We're talking about protecting your bones into your 80s, your 90s. For many of us, it's going to be past 100, so that it's a very inexpensive and low-risk treatment. And the question, if we allow some of our patients to become deficient in calcium and vitamin D, that is definitely a negative. And this group, there were no deficiencies because they tracked what kind of intake they were getting overall, as well as their supplementation.
Yeah. The thing that I think about with a study like this, and it seems that we, on a fairly regular basis, there are stories in the news about various kinds of health studies. And often we see these things where some study will come along and say, well, you know that thing we told you about, you know, that you were supposed to be doing? Well, I think we've decided we're not sure whether it's a benefit or not. And then, of course, people say, well, you doctors, you know, you're telling us one thing and you're telling us something else. Like, the thing that I think about is this. If you're going to do a study that involves some kind of intervention and that you're hoping, you want to see, does it have some sort of a beneficial effect? The question is, at what point in the person's life do you start this, and how long is it going to go, and how long would it take, given the fact that for the previous however many years of their life, they had been doing something different, maybe even something counterproductive. That, you know, that's like the idea that I think we know that heart disease can start very early in a person's life. Say maybe when they were in a teenager, you can start to see the beginnings of heart disease. Then, though, if you really start to intervene in a positive way and you don't start to do that until the person is 30 or 40, then you've got all this history that you've got to make up for.
It's,
you know, so
true.
You sort of wonder how do you
but
size
then
all that
those
up?
Studies are very helpful because the 40-year-old that hasn't had intervention is walking into your front door, and you do want to say, okay, give me some information that's going to help me with that patient to going forward in time. So that's good. And also, we have refined our research techniques. And the FDA has been very firm about this with some of the medications that we use. There are some medications that have been on the market for so long that they were tested with very much older research techniques. Laboratory values weren't as consistent or accurate as they are now. The group size, the way we interpret the statistics has changed. The way we handle who is blinded to the therapy. So now if a properly controlled study that is looking at a particular medicine, the physicians that are evaluating the patients are not usually told what group the patient was in. So, you know, that's one of the kind of ironic things. Very often I participate in a lot of research studies, and they even specifically tell us, don't try to guess what the patient's on. You're supposed to be objective and evaluate how is the patient doing on this blinded medication. And so people say to me, so how's the drug working out? Well, aside from the fact that you do sign, when you do some of these studies, you do sign confidentiality agreements. So that prohibits you from giving out all the information, of course. But aside from that, if I'm blinded to the treatment, I can't really even say until the very end of the study when they've processed all the data and they finally will unblind and let me know what patients were on what. And I can go back and see what I thought and correlate it with what the patient was taking. So that's a very long process. And so we do want, it is important for patients to know that even though we do contradict ourselves compared to some older studies, sometimes it's because a much better study now has been done.
Well, okay, so specifically as far as calcium goes.
As far as calcium goes, I think what's important to know that it's a very important nutrient. So you need to look at your diet and you need to get your intake up to a basic recommended daily amount, and same with vitamin D, and then be evaluated beyond that. So women in menopause, really, the National Osteoporosis Foundation still says supplemental calcium for most patients is beneficial. But I think based on this study, we can say that if you wanted to go to your physician and say, this is my diet, these are my risk factors, here's my current bone density, what do you think I should do in terms of calcium intake? I think there may be some patients that can be very healthy without necessarily getting these supplementations. What I usually tell my patients is pay attention to your diet on a day-to-day basis. So if you were traveling or it was a holiday and you were eating very irregularly or your diet wasn't as balanced as it should be, that for sure probably is a supplementation day. Whereas if it happened to be a day with a lot of calcium intake in your food, you're probably getting enough calcium. So there are ways to balance out your calcium through your nutrition.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has a practice here in our area. She teaches at the med school, and once a month on a Monday, she's here. We talk about women's health and whatever might be on your mind. As long as it has to do with her area of practice, you can call, and I know that she will do her best to give you an answer. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL or 9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We do have a couple of callers here, and we'll talk with someone on a cell phone on line 4 to start out with. Hello.
Hello, Dr. Truppen. Two questions. First of all, on topic, what level or what degree of weight-bearing exercise is recommended for women, perimenopausal or menopausal women, to prevent or reduce osteoporosis? And on an unrelated topic, I recently found out that a very good friend of mine, a perimenopausal woman, is using androgen gel, apparently, for enhanced libido. And I'd like you to speak to the consequences and the therapeutic effects, et cetera, that kind of stuff. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, when it comes to exercise, of course, we always focus on heart health. And we used to say 20 minutes a day, and there are some guidelines that say up to a full hour a day is what's optimum for maximum heart health. We also usually talk about weight loss. And if you're newly starting a weight loss program, probably up to an hour a day would work. But if you are long-term and you're trying to maintain some weight loss, they even talk about 90 minutes a day, which most of us do not have. In terms of weight-bearing, to help your bones. Many of the studies have done a full hour of some sort of weight-bearing exercise. Some studies have shown that even 30 minutes a day is enough. And some studies have shown that if you're going to do something brief like weightlifting, it could be as short as 10 to 15 minutes as part of your overall exercise program. There have even been studies of what has traditionally been called non-weight-bearing exercise, swimming, and even swimmers compared to sedentary people had a better overall bone density. So it may not only be the weight bearing itself. It may have to do with the function of muscles around the bone, which has some subclinical effects of electricity and various other kinds of forces on the spine. I think there was a big story. Madonna was using some magnetic frequencies and something to help improve her bones. And actually, there have been some studies that show that that's beneficial as well. So I think for the bottom line for most people, if you're in a good solid exercise program, you're doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. And again, for most of us, on the other side of the table, trying to give advice, we try to look at the whole patient and what can you do if you have arthritis, if you have knee conditions, if you have medical reasons that compromise or change the type of exercise that you can do. You have to work within your framework of overall health. And I think that's going to be the most important. Switching over to your second question, male hormones, particularly within menopause, have been shown to increase libido. And yet, when we look at the average menopausal patient who still has her ovaries, she will have in early menopause the same level of male hormones that she had prior to going through menopause when the ovary quits making estrogen but continues to make testosterone, the primary male androgen, out of the ovary. As she gets farther into menopause, 10, 20 years out, the average menopausal patient will have less androgen, perhaps even go down by half or slightly more, but still often her androgen levels are in the same range as in premenopause. Androgen studies, there was a study recently published of in Trinza, a testosterone patch that leaks some natural testosterone across the skin into the patient, did show improvement of overall sex drive and benefit in the number of episodes of sex per month. It was something like 1.5 additional sexual episodes per month, which the FDA decided not to approve the product, stating that maybe there's not enough known long term and there's not is that enough benefit versus risk? And so we don't know what the FDA will eventually do, but there was definitely some benefit. There is a medicine on the market that physicians can prescribe that's a pill of estrogen and testosterone, and there are many studies to show benefit in energy level, less depression, actually better muscle and overall fitness, as well as improvement in both sexual drive and sexual function. And that medicine's called Estratest. In terms of androgen gels, without knowing what it is, I can't really comment, but most are some form of testosterone that's being applied topically to leak across the skin. If it's something that's compounded, it may or may not be of a density or dosage that's going to get a therapeutic level equivalent to what we've seen in these studies. But if it was strong enough and you did get a level equivalent to in the studies, there seems to be improvement. Now, prior to menopause, the two biggest complaints of sexual dysfunction are, and I think I talked about this briefly last month, but one is HSDD, hypoactive sexual desire disorder, and one is FSAD, female sexual arousal disorder. So in the first group of patients, they're having trouble getting enthusiastic about sex. They're just, their overall libido is low. Their sex drive is low. The second group, their libido may or may not be low, particularly if this has gone on for a while, but they are having trouble getting aroused. In neither of these groups of patients has testosterone been shown to be effective. And there are many theories about what might work to improve. We just don't have that female Viagra yet. And we're actually participating in two different studies, studying very different compounds for these groups of patients, but probably looking to androgen supplementation in the premenopausal group is not going to be successful.
Okay, I hope that helps. Just for a real brief second, going back to the discussion we were having about weight-bearing exercise, I think maybe it would be worth mentioning that what we're not talking about an enormous amount of weight.
Correct.
We're not talking about, you know, going to the gym and lifting huge amounts of weight. That apparently there is good research to show that smaller amounts of weight can have a benefit.
And even walking.
Yes.
Walking.
Yes.
But walking is a little more weight-bearing than, say, biking. And, you know, so it is a subject we could get very in-depth about. But, right.
So maybe, I don't know, maybe at some future point we'd have some exercise expert here on the program and really talk about that, because it seems that it's been shown it can be good for women of all ages, particularly older women. It can help for women if they're concerned about maintaining a healthy weight. There can be all sorts of benefits, and it doesn't have to be real hardcore strenuous iron pumping to get
and
the
here
result.
At the University of Illinois, Dr. Ellen Evans in the Department of Kinesiology is an expert on exercise and osteoporosis. So there's a suggestion for you.
Yeah, we should do that. All right. Well, we'll go back to our callers here. Next is someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Following up on your calcium comments, I missed the beginning, so I apologize if you've answered this. But I have heard that for some medications, like for high blood pressure or cholesterol reduction and so forth, that if you take those at the same time you take calcium supplements, that some of these other medicines don't absorb correctly. Does it have a blockage problem?
Some molecules in calcium do compete for their types of absorption. And so not only would you possibly not get a good absorption of your medication, but you might not get the full effectiveness from the calcium. And I think that it's one of those items that you need to discuss with your physician or your pharmacist when you pick up your medicine. And if you've newly started any kind of vitamin supplementation or herbal supplementation or additional calcium, it's always worth checking that package insert. And even if you've been on the same medicine for a long period of time, checking that there's no new information that would impact on your dosage or the way you time your medicine.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Here is someone in Urbana next, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Could you please discuss menopause and sleep disorders and if there might be some sort of connection or how menopause might affect one's thyroid?
Well, we know that I'll do the second first.
Thank you.
it's easier.
Okay.
But we know that as women age, they're a little bit more likely to have thyroid disorders. And we know also that high levels of soy consumption can affect your thyroid. And so there's been a little trend in the United States for menopausal women to increase their soy intake, and that can affect their overall thyroid medication. But we don't think that menopause specifically is a big cause of thyroid dysfunction in large groups of patients, but it could affect an individual patient.
Okay. Do you mind if I ask, so if like you're allergic to milk and you're replacing milk with soy products, might that have some sort of effect?
It might have an effect. And one thing that's nice about thyroid and thyroid treatment is it's very easy to test. They're very accurate blood levels that can be checked. And so it's something that you could work with your own healthcare provider to check to make sure that there is no deficiency that has developed. They've also, the American College of Endocrinologists has also changed a little bit their assessment of what a normal thyroid level is. And so that may vary from lab to lab and expert to expert. So that's one thing that's a little bit controversial with thyroid treatment.
Okay.
Now, in terms of menopause and sleep, we think that anything that disrupts your full night's sleep will cause a number of health effects. So moodiness, feeling tired in the morning, not feeling rested, less quick in your thinking, less easy recall. Those things will all be affected by how much sleep you get. And in the menopausal time, we do notice that women have increased sleep problems. And the question is why and how that can be fixed. We know that as you go into the perimenopause, so the official definition of menopause is one full year with no menstrual period. Well, that time, that 11 months before you're formally menopausal is definitely the perimenopausal time. And there may be 1 to 2 years prior to that time where estrogen function is decreasing from the ovary. You won't miss it. The ovary's not like a tank of estrogen running out of gas. You may have ups and downs in the level of estrogen. But during that time, the overall, what we call the area under the curve, so generally speaking, the amount of estrogen in your system is decreasing. And as a consequence of that, women get these physiologic changes we call vasomotor symptoms. And, you know, average patient out there, if you asked her, how's your vasomotor symptoms going? She might not know, but most of us just call them hot flashes. And the first hot flashes that women seem to get is at night. And if we do sleep studies on perimenopausal and menopausal women, they tend to have these hot flashes that occur at night. They have various hormonal surges that accompany what else is going on with them physiologically, which may be skin temperature change or internal body temperature change, maybe a little bit of racing of the heart as well as these fluctuations in hormones. And those hot flashes occurring during the night do disrupt sleep patterns, so that if you study a menopausal patient clinically, she will report what we call longer sleep latency, so taking longer to fall asleep. Mm-hmm. She will report more night wakenings.
Yes.
And she will report just overall less hours of sleep and feeling less rested when she gets up. If you put her in a sleep lab and you try to correlate that with what's going on, you will see that she will have less REM sleep. And we think that it's the REM, the dream sleep, that is the most restful. So you can actually see changes in her fine sleep patterns. Now, this is another one of those things that doctors have. We've gone a little back and forth about all this. So on any given day, I may be telling you something accurate or something inaccurate. But we have done studies showing that estrogen supplementation improves both the clinical parameters of sleep and the scientific parameters. In other words, estrogen supplementation has improved sleep latency. Patients get to sleep faster. They've stayed asleep longer with less sleep disruption, and they've awoken more rested. Now, we've been able to show this as well with certain sleep medications. And one of the problems with sleep is it's a very learned behavior, so that if we want a nurse to work all night long, we can teach her to be perfectly awake all night long and be sleepy during the day. But if we ask her then to come in the day she's supposed to sleep, she'll be quite sleepy during the day because her pattern has changed. And so if you've allowed yourself to get into a pattern where you wake up a lot, trying to break that pattern seems to be as much part of the cure as a physiologic cure.
Okay.
So that seems to be. Now, there have been some recent studies, along with all this other stuff that's turned estrogen therapy on its ear, there have been some recent studies that showed that estrogen alone was not effective in improving sleep. And again, it probably has to do with the timing, the dose, the patient, where in her menopausal continuum is she? What else is going on with her health status and her sleep status? You know, is she overweight? Does she have sleep apnea? There are a number of medical conditions that contribute to poor sleep.
Okay. Well, you've answered a lot of my questions. Thank you very much.
All right. Very good. Thank
Bye-bye.
You for the call. We will continue. Next up is Bloomington, Illinois, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a friend who, you mentioned temperature fluctuations with menopause.
Yes.
And I have a friend who's been doing a lot of lab testing because she's been running usually a low-grade fever for about 2 to 3 months, sometimes going up to almost 100, but usually around 99.5, something like that. And I wondered if that could be a result of that and how you would narrow that down to that.
Well, one of the things you quickly learn in medical school is there's no way, even on the biggest test of your life, that you can name all the different things that cause fever to fluctuate. And there are many people who end up with this FUO, fever of unknown origin. So unfortunately, figuring out where fever fluctuations are, if that is really the only thing that is going on, sometimes can be very difficult. The temperature fluctuations that we see with menopause don't tend to be as dramatic as what you're talking about. The average patient's temperature should be 98.6, and that means that internally she's probably about a degree warmer. So internally she's probably 99.6, but the temperatures you're referring to, the 100 to the 92, usually if in a hot flash or feeling warm, the internal temperature may only creep up a few tenths of a degree or as much as a degree. So it's unlikely that menopause alone would be causing this. And if so, it would probably be a fluctuating thing that could be correlated with when she gets a hot flash. And much of the warmness is strictly a change in the surface temperature of the skin that isn't generally measured by the average temperature taking. That has to be something measured with sophisticated skin thermometers that we use in research studies.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you for the call. Others, welcome. We have about 10 minutes left here with Dr. Suzanne Troop. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You said one of the things that maybe you might want to talk a little bit about is some concerns that have to do with blood clots and contraceptive patch.
Right. We know that estrogen changes the blood clotting factors in our liver. And actually, there are some individuals who have a predisposition to forming clots a little bit more likely based on some of their genetic background and the type of clotting factors they produce out of their liver. So that the average young woman has a risk of forming a blood clot of about 1 in 10,000. Something like that. And if you're pregnant, the risk of forming a blood clot might go up to as high as 6 to 7 out of 10,000, because the levels of estrogen in pregnancy are so high, the liver starts to make these additional clotting factors. We've always thought that for most patients, when they get on birth control pills or any form of what we call steroid contraception that has estrogen in it, they probably generally don't change the level of clinical risk of a blood clot very much. But some studies, it does creep up to about 3 out of 10,000. So about half the risk that you would have if you were becoming pregnant, but three times the risk if you were never pregnant. But overall, we're talking about extremely rare things. So an individual physician may never see this. It turns out that if you're using a birth control pill patch, because you're wearing that patch all the time and you're taking it very consistently, many pill users skip one or two now and then. So you're using it more consistently, wearing it all the time. You're getting a bigger area under the curve of the amount of estrogen exposure. So you're getting about 60% higher amount of estrogen exposure to if you compare it to the average birth control pill. And that probably is going to translate into a very slightly higher clinical risk of blood clot. And for patients who have family reasons to be at increased risk, they might even be at more risk. So that we're asking clinicians to evaluate their patients for the best method for them, understand the risks and benefits, and work up patients that have family risk factors, and particularly in smokers who are already predisposed to have higher rates than I'm quoting of these blood clots, perhaps the patch is not going to be a good method for them in all cases.
Okay. To the phones again. On a cell phone here, someone on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to get your comment on the combination of calcium and magnesium together versus taking calcium by itself.
For bone health? We think magnesium is often an important component in both our diet and our overall health. There's been some suggestion that it may also be beneficial for overall heart health. And again, you need a basic amount of magnesium in your food each day to have overall bone health. But most of us are going to get that in our food, and most of us probably won't need magnesium, additional magnesium supplementation. So the basic recommendations by the National Osteoporosis Foundation for bone health really focus on calcium and vitamin D and not these other things, although we know magnesium is important. Some of the minor minerals are important. Vitamin K is important. We think that in addition, phosphorus is important in some patients. So we do have other minerals and nutrients that are important for bone health, but not necessary to recommend the whole population supplement with them.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Over to caller here in Indiana. Line one. Hello.
Hello. Anecdotally, thinking about my family's history and other women I've known, I never heard ever mentioned about kidney stones, but I know a number of guys, including myself, who have been told, now you know what it's like having a baby. And I just wondered, is kidney stones a rare thing for women, or is it something that just doesn't get reported and it's not a press thing? Thanks a lot.
Women do get kidney stones, and it's extraordinarily painful for anybody that gets a kidney stone. And absolutely, the pain has been compared to labor, and it sets on you fast, and you probably don't have all that good Le Mans training to help you cycle prophylax against it, and it's very troublesome. We have been talking so much about calcium. I should probably mention that about 4,500 milligrams of calcium a day has been thought to be too much. So people say, well, if I just add in calcium, am I going to increase my risk of kidney stone? Well, not at these basic levels, but about four times what was recommended in that study I've been talking about is probably too much, and you probably could increase your risk of kidney stones. But it is seen in all individuals, all age group. Lack of hydration, so not enough water drinking. Some studies with caffeine, because caffeine is a little bit dehydrating if you take it in high levels, and a pop, and that may or may not be related to the caffeine. It may be related more to the carbonation of the pop and causing calcium levels to change. So there are a number of factors that are known as risk factors, but they do occur in both sexes.
Mm-hmm. Is it true that there are some people who seem to have a tendency to form stones and other people not, and maybe we don't exactly know why? And so in that sense, you know, some individual could take just a ton of calcium and would not have any problem at all, and somebody else could take, you know, more like what's the recommended amount, and they could be the one that would have the problem?
Yes, that is probably true, but it probably is more related to other factors rather than their calcium intake, at least in most studies. Unless you really pour in the calcium, no matter who you are, it hasn't increased your risk of a stone.
Okay. We certainly have time to talk a little bit more. Was there something else that you wanted to
mention? I didn't know if I would get through those topics or not. I wanted to talk a little bit more about osteoporosis. There was a new medication approved for treatment of osteoporosis. We talk a lot about the bisphosphonates, and the two bisphosphonates that have been around for the longest time treatment-wise for prevention and treatment of osteoporosis have been Fosamax and Actonel. And then relatively recently, we had the approval of a once-a-month pill, the Beneva, and now the FDA has approved Beneva for injection treatment. And the injection takes 15 to 30 seconds. You need it four times a year, so you don't have to take it orally. And this is probably going to be a benefit for convenience-wise, but also is going to be a benefit for people who get the heartburn, or, you know, technically esophagitis, or the stomach, the GI symptoms with more frequent oral intake of the bisphosphonates. So that was something new.
So you don't get that at all when you inject? the medication?
The studies show a very, very low rate of that. Yeah. And, you know, we don't eliminate it because we even see it in some of the placebo groups of patients. But yes, you eliminate the stomach because that seems to be a direct effect of contact of the medication with those tissues.
Okay. To cell phone here for another caller, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering, I've just turned 50, and in my mid-40s, I was put on birth control pills as sort of a plan for perimenopause. But talking to my doctor last year, she said to figure out if I was in menopause, I needed to go off the pill and then come in and have my blood work. Well, as a teacher, I'd like to go off in the summer. How long do I have to be off the pill before a blood test would show whether or not I was in menopause or perimenopause or whatever you want to call the spectrum?
Most patients that are taking birth control pills are still taking the old-fashioned way of administering birth control pills, meaning 3 weeks of active pills and
right.
a week of inactive pill. And mm-hmm. actually, if you get your blood tested towards the end of the week of the inactive pill, it's usually pretty accurate with respect to menopause. The other thing is to just assume that you're going to go through menopause at the average age of menopause, which is 51.4 years. And it's pretty universal around the world, even in Aboriginal cultures or Europe or United States or South America. For some reason, this is one very universal number. But anything after, we used to say 45, but actually most books now say 40. But anything after the age of 40 and anything up to the age of 55 would be considered normal. So that about the oldest we ever leave patients on oral contraceptives is age 55. And for most patients, they can safely go off their pills at 52, 53, and no longer need protection against ovulation or contraception effectiveness and hormonal supplementation for patients in their early 50s with menopausal doses of estrogen and progesterone is usually a significantly lower dose of estrogen and progesterone than what you're getting in your pill. So once you get past that age of, you know, so you can do it scientifically and mm-hmm. do the blood test towards the end of your pill-free week.
Okay.
And or you can do it more clinically and kind of stick on them till about 52, 53 and then either try completely off or tapering on to a menopausal dose of hormone.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. At what point would you, in all of this process, would you expect a woman to stop having periods? And then how long, how many months would, is it standard to go before you would say, okay, you've gone this many months without having a period, you're not pregnant, therefore you're done?
Well, the official definition is one full year, 12
okay,
months.
So going an entire year without
an
periods.
Entire year without periods. Okay. If you're like the last caller and you are on oral contraceptives, you'll continue to have a period as long as you keep taking those pills the way they're recommended. And that's another thing that we've started to look at, changing the way pills are given. So we had the longer cycle pill Seasonal that came out first, and we've got another pill that's going to be a one full year of dosage without any breaks that's about to come out. And then I've talked about the pill Yasmin has been studied for prevention of PMS. And when we studied Yasmin, it didn't work. It was no different than placebo in terms of preventing PMS. But when we studied it with a slightly different formula, so instead of 21 active, 7 inactive, we did 24 and 4. So only 4 days of placebo or no hormonal supplementation. It was very effective at prevention of premenstrual symptoms. And that pill is now going to be marketed as Yaz. I know I've had calls from patients who've seen it written in magazines as if it's already on the shelf, which it's not, but it's going to be, and it's going to be called Yaz, Y-A-Z.
Yeah, okay. Any last thing you'd want to mention here?
Well, I know a lot of men called. I was impressed with that. And I know I talk a lot about the different studies that we do for women. And we have one study that's enrolling both women and men. And specifically, more along some of the lines of what you were talking about, we're looking at why approximately half of all people with heart attacks and strokes do seem to have normal cholesterol. What else is going wrong there? And we think that the answer may be in the level of inflammation in their blood. So we're doing a study looking for men over the age of 50. Women can actually be in this study if they're over 60, not on any cholesterol-lowering medicines, but with fairly normal cholesterol levels to get their blood drawn. If they happen to have an elevated rate of C-reactive protein, we're going to be following two groups of patients, one on a treatment and one on placebo, over about 3.5-4 years of time. It's kind of an exciting study. There are probably 5,000 investigators worldwide investigating various aspects of heart disease, and this one particular study will probably be enrolling many thousands and thousands of patients. So it's kind of fun to be part of a big group.
Well, there we will leave it this time around with the promise that Dr. Troopman will be back next month. She's here on the fourth Monday of the month in the 11 o'clock hour now. We've been doing that at 11 for a while to talk about women's health. She is an OBGYN with a practice here in our area. She also teaches at U of I Med School. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.